You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon members. Thank you so much.
Join our Patreon for extra episodes, interviews, extra content, and to help support the podcast and help us continue to do the work we do.
Go to patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl to learn more. Hell yes. Strong, powerful warrior queens.
You stand on the banks of the great river, shading your eye to stare across its expanse at the marshaled forces of your enemy. They're practicing their drills now, in the shadow of the city walls, your men hidden from them. An army 30,000 strong, just under their noses and across the river, and they don't even know you're here. You glance back at your men and then down at the missive in your fist. You have just received word that your sister to the north, Cleopatra, had taken her own life. After years of war, the rest and pull of diplomacy, after all else failed, she chose her own path. It was an honorable path, but it won't be yours. Now the great Caesar, so he calls himself, has taken her country and made it his own, and he wants to do the same to yours. As soon as he conquered Egypt, he turned his gaze south. You shade your eyes against the glare and stare across the river at the agent Caesar sent to conquer you, Petronius. I can see his face, says your companion, an accomplished bowman. I can put an arrow in his eye from here. He draws back his bow. No, you say, let's do this right. Let them not say the great warrior queen of Cush killed her enemy from hiding. However much you hate him, Caesar is not a stupid man. All that gold, the piles and piles of it, that storied treasure of the Ptolemies, it came from your kingdom, your gold, dredged from your mines and your riverbeds. That's why he wants what's yours. Cleopatra could not, in the end, protect what was hers. But she, for all her gifts, was no warrior. You will show her ghost how it's done. You gather your reins and signal your men. It's time.
I'm Jenny Williamson.
And I'm Jen McMenemy.
And this is Ancient History Fangirl. When we think of pyramids, hieroglyphs, pharaohs, and an ancient kingdom on the Nile that gave rise to one of humanity's most fascinating ancient cultures, we think about Egypt. You think about Egypt, don't you? You probably think about Egypt, right?
I'm not ashamed to admit it. Usually I do. But I'm about to be schooled in the best possible way.
Yeah, most people do think about Egypt. However, did you know that there was a civilization to the south of Egypt that was just as fascinating, just as complex, just as sophisticated, and it was not Egypt? It was Nubia.
I'm here for this. Please tell me everything.
Nubia doesn't get as much attention as Egypt, but they had everything Egypt had and more. The Nubians built temples, cities, and pyramids to rival those of the Egyptians. And the Nubians had a fascinating history of strong female leaders, including warriors, generals, and queens. For millennia, Egypt and Nubia fought, traded, conquered each other, and communicated with a great deal of cultural exchange. And where Cleopatra took her own life after losing to Rome, her sister to the south, well, they weren't really sisters, but her compatriot to the south, a one-eyed warrior queen of Nubia, successfully fought off the Roman army, held a knife to its throat, and wrung a peace treaty out of Octavian that kept her kingdom free for centuries more.
So cool. I mean, mostly I'm just here for anyone holding a knife to the throat of Octavian. But, you know, that's me.
I mean, I think that's all of us, Jen. That is all of us. Unless we're Octavian, I guess.
Ancient Nubia was just as fascinating and complex and unique as Egypt. The Nubians built more pyramids than the Egyptians, but theirs aren't as famous. Why is that? Some of it has to do with racism.
Both ancient Egypt and ancient Nubia were incredibly diverse places. Ancient artwork depicts people from both cultures as black, whereas Egyptian history was whitewashed at certain points, and still we could probably say this is a problem today, Nubian history wasn't to the same extent. Racism has affected how the Nubians were seen at many points in history, including in more modern times.
The Nubians had hieroglyphics, just like the Egyptians did. However, they often wrote in their own language, and we haven't found a Rosetta Stone for it yet. That means most of what we know about Nubia, from its own time, comes from Egyptian artwork and writing. And Egypt was a problematic source. The Egyptians were, often, not always, enemies of Nubia, and scholars have noted that they often described the Nubians in negative terms. This view has come down to us in more modern times, affecting the way more recent scholars have looked at Nubia, as a sort of lesser neighbor and imitator of Egypt.
In reality, the Nubians were trade partners, marriage partners, both imitated and were imitated by the Egyptians, and were both conquered by and conquerors of Egypt. These two kingdoms were in an intricate, intimate dance since the beginning. You can't tell the story of Egypt, the real story, without talking about Nubia. Today, scholars are working to overcome long-standing racist and colonialist attitudes about Nubia to truly understand this ancient and sophisticated culture in its own right, and not just as a reflection of ancient Egypt. This is the story of Nubia.
So, Nubia was Egypt's neighbor to the south, the upper region of the Nile, because the Nile flows north. It was known for its rich gold deposits and was a source of endless wealth for the Egyptians through trade and conquest. Gold, ivory, ebony, incense, and rare animal skins were among the luxury goods that flowed from Nubia. Similar to Egypt, Nubia was a kingdom whose entire world was the Nile, a large, powerful, but very predictable and navigable river, a lifeline in a vast desert. They settled on fertile strips of land on both sides of this mighty river. Their seasons were marked by Nile flooding. They oriented themselves by the river. Essentially, their north was upriver, which would make it our south.
It's actually really interesting, though, like the way that upper and lower Egypt is directly opposed to what we see as upper and lower of anything. Their directionality, like the way that they oriented themselves, was based on that river and how it flowed. So kind of their north is our south in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
At over 4,130 miles long, the Nile is the world's second longest river, second only to the Amazon. In ancient times, the Nile flooded every year during the monsoon season between May and August. That's when monsoon rains fell on the far-off Ethiopian highlands, where the Nile has its sources. Every year, the Nile River overwhelmed its banks and flooded the fields on either side for acres or miles. It does this less in modern times due to dams. The ancient Egyptians predicted the flood for the upcoming season using nilometers. The oldest version was a tower built directly into the river, with levels marked to predict various outcomes. Low water levels at a certain time of year indicated upcoming famines. High water levels predicted dangerous floods. And somewhere in the middle, you had a mark that indicated a good harvest. Predicting the upcoming season was the purview of the priests. The Egyptians divided their year into three seasons: Akhet, Peret, and Shamu. Akhet was the time of flooding, Peret was the season of growing, and Shamu was the season of harvest. While we don't know for sure, it's likely the Nubians similarly divided their year into three seasons depending on the Nile cycle, since they were heavily agricultural.
The Nile is very easy to travel by boat. That's because while its current flows north, its prevailing winds blow south. For those sailing on the river, all they have to do is take down their sails to go north, or rely on wind power to go south. However, that travel has historically been blocked by the cataracts. The cataracts are shallow, rocky areas of the Nile that are basically whitewater rapids and impassable by boat. Since ancient times, travelers wanting to pass the cataracts have had to take their boats out of the river and drag them along the banks to get them to the other side of the cataracts. There are six cataracts on the Nile. The first is just north of Aswan, an ancient frontier city just below the first cataract. For much of Egyptian history, The first cataract was its southernmost or uppermost boundary, separating them from Nubia. Although that wasn't the case at all times, there are five more cataracts, and all were in the region of ancient Nubia. Two are submerged today due to various dams.
Like Egypt, Nubia was divided into regions based on where they were on the Nile. Lower Nubia was the northernmost section, south of the first cataract. That was the part that bordered Egypt. And again, these borders shifted throughout the centuries, so in general. Middle Nubia was between the second and third cataracts, and south of the third cataract lay Upper Nubia. It stretched south to the point where the Blue Nile and White Nile joined to form the Nile, basically, just south of the sixth cataract. That's where the city of Khartoum is today. Archaeological evidence suggests people lived in the area of ancient Nubia for the past 50,000 years. At the site of Afad 23 between the third and fourth cataracts, an ancient hunting camp has been discovered buried under flood deposits that's more than 50,000 years old. Here, people practiced hunting and gathering and fished for Nile catfish, which is electric and delivers a shock of up to 350 volts. I bet you didn't know that.
I did not. That's amazing. Also so dangerous.
They also hunted antelope and auroch, the wild ancestor of domestic cattle. The auroch remains found here are the southernmost found anywhere in the world.
By around 5000 BC, refugees from the Green Sahara fled the rapidly expanding desert and settled on the Nile. It's clear the people here were very sophisticated even then. It's these people who built the spectacular Nabta Playa, displaying an ability to build megalithic structures aligned with the stars as far back as 7500 BC. They domesticated cattle, and ancient rock art around this time give hints of cattle cults. It also depicts people hunting with bows and arrows. And that's going to be important later. Just put that in the back of your mind in your little memory palace.
By roughly around 3800 BC, the people in Nubia had evolved into a culture that archaeologists today call the A group. Not a lot is known about the A group, but they were the first powerful, influential culture in Nubia, and they lived from roughly the first to second cataracts. They were sophisticated traders even then. They traded with their neighbors to the north, or in their worldview, probably downriver or the south, the people who would become the Egyptians. Even as far back as this, they traded in priceless carnelian, incense, ivory, ebony, luxury goods. Archaeologists have traced contacts between A-group Nubian people and the Gash group, an ancient culture to the west in the deserts of what's now Sudan. That could have been the land of Punt. It's one of the top contenders, I believe. Nubia was the trading hub that all the luxury goods of the desert flowed through before they reached Egypt. They were the middlemen, and they got rich doing it. If you remember at Hatshepsut's tomb when she was talking about trying to sidestep middlemen, what she might have been trying to do was sidestep Nubia, potentially.
Absolutely. But long before the Egyptian pharaohs, the Nubians were especially known for their gold. They had rich gold deposits, and their country was one of the places Egypt got its gold from. The Egyptians both traded for gold and set up their own fortified towns within Nubian territory to mine gold. In fact, the word Nubia may be based on Nub, the Egyptian word for gold, although that's not known for sure. The A-group Nubians also built elaborate necropolises, with hundreds of graves containing pottery, jewelry, incense burners, and other artifacts, some of which displayed imagery we associate with pharaonic Egypt, way before pharaonic Egypt existed. The first Egyptian pharaoh, Narmer, lived roughly in the 3200s BC. Narmer's name means stinging catfish. The goods found in A-group Nubian graves have caused some historians to argue about whether the traditions of rulership that eventually evolved into the first pharaonic dynasty actually originated south of the first cataract in Nubia.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
Around 3100 BC, at the founding of Egypt's first dynasty, the Egyptians destroyed Group A Nubia. This event has not been well documented. I couldn't find that much information about how or why this happened. But it may have been part of Narmer's, i.e. the stinging catfish's, efforts to unify lands along the Nile. What seems to have happened in reality, though, is that the ancestral land of Nubia became entirely depopulated, possibly because of Egyptian raiding and violence. This appears to have been the situation for the next 600 years or so. Nubia starts to be mentioned again in ancient Egyptian sources around 2300 BC, 2500 to 2300 BC, as a trade partner and a source for all of the luxury goods, ebony, ivory, copper, exotic animals and animal skins, and most importantly, gold. By 2500 BC or so, it seems that people came back to Nubia. Whether they were the same people as the A group is not known, but this time, they reinvented themselves into the powerful Kingdom of Kerma.
The Kingdom of Kerma was an agricultural kingdom centered around a large town between the Third and Fourth Cataracts, called Kerma. The Kingdom of Kerma appears to have controlled territory from the First to Fourth Cataract along the Nile, making it as large as ancient Egypt at the time. Kerma wasn't the kingdom's only town. There were others, many of them located along different Nile tributaries and channels which have since run dry. But the town of Kerma was the center of this kingdom's power. It was a large urban center built around a large adobe temple with homes, workshops, and a large necropolis that held over 30,000 graves, many of which appear to be royal burials.
Burial traditions varied depending on the time period, but the way some of the burials were arranged with a large tomb surrounded by smaller burials have led some to suggest that the people at Kerma practiced human sacrifice, putting close family members or retainers to death when an important person died, which is something the ancient Egyptians may also have done at certain points in their history. This is, however, heavily disputed. Either way, Kerma was a very important center for trade in the region. And while Kerma, the kingdom, was heavily agricultural, that wasn't its only industry. The Egyptians spoke of a rich, highly populated kingdom, populated both by farmers and pastoralists shepherding sheep, goats, and cattle, as well as gold mining and processing industries. Royalty and Kerma were buried in the city with hundreds of cattle, suggesting the presence of a cattle cult. An analysis of the skulls of cattle suggests they were brought from large distances away, implying that the rulers of Kerma either controlled or traded with vast territories.
But Kerma may not have controlled all the territory, even in Nubia. Not everyone living in that territory may have identified as part of the Kingdom of Kerma. This was a highly diverse area. Archaeologists describe at least three main cultures present here. Rural cattle herders living to the north near the First Cataract. Archaeologists call them the C group. The sophisticated Kerma culture to the south, mainly agricultural with several urban centers. And another group of rural pastoralists to the east, tending herds of goats, sheep, and cattle. All were Nubian, but each culture had its own unique identity.
By 2000 or so, the ancient Egyptians had started to call Nubia by another name, Kush. And I've seen different explanations of Kush versus Nubia versus Kerma, these names that we use and what exactly they're referring to. Some people use them interchangeably. So what I think, just trying to parse through this, is that Nubia refers to the wider region of the first through sixth cataracts, roughly in modern-day Sudan, which wasn't necessarily politically unified. The kingdom of Kush was a smaller kingdom within larger Nubia. That was like one of the groups. And Kerma, this large city, was its first capital, although in earlier periods, I also see Kerma referred to as its own kingdom. So this may have been the case before the word Kush started to appear. So the ancient Egyptians had one more name for their neighbors to the south, Ta Seti, or Land of the Bow. The Nubians were expert archers. Their tradition of archery was ancient and probably originated in hunting, as the rock art as far back as 5000 BC attests. Nubian bowmen were renowned in the ancient world. The ancient Egyptians both fought them and hired them as mercenaries. Nubian bowmen appear on the walls of Egyptian tombs. In fact, as far back as 2000 BC, one of the pharaohs, Meseti, was buried with a collection of 40 exquisitely detailed models of Nubian archers.
The iconic Nubian bow was a self bow, a kind of bow made from a single piece of wood. These bows were enormous, as much as 6 feet tall. These were heavy war bows. Ancient Egyptian sources rave about their power, range, and accuracy. According to them, a Nubian archer could put out your eye as soon as you were close enough to make out your face. The Nubian archers wore stone thumb rings to improve the strength and accuracy of their shot. Many thumb rings have been found in Nubian graves. This type of bow was meant to be used on foot. Nubian archers were infantry. Unlike the English longbow, their massive bows curved in toward the archer slightly at the tips to increase firing power even further. These appear to be the dominant type of bow in Nubia until the rise of a composite recurve bow, similar to those of the Scythian steppe archers, which rose in popularity in the 300s BC.
Perhaps the first Egyptian who used Nubian archers as mercenaries was a general called Weni. He lived during the 6th dynasty of Egypt, roughly around 2300 BC, so right at the beginning of the history of Kush. Weni served under several pharaohs and had a very eventful life. He investigated the pharaoh's harem to rout out conspiracy among the queens and concubines. He reorganized the Egyptian army to improve discipline, reduce pillage, and minimize infighting, shaping it into a form that was used all the way up to the new kingdom. And he served as a judge, advisor, and general to pharaohs. We know about his life because he had his autobiography inscribed on the walls of his tomb. Throughout the Old Kingdom, Egypt and Nubia fought, Kushites venturing north to raid Egyptian settlements, and Egyptians venturing south to pillage in return. Weni governed an area that would have been a highly contested border region. He fought the Nubians, and he hired Nubian bowmen to help him.
And you might ask, what Nubian bowmen would willingly work for the Egyptians to beat up on their own? Well, the thing is that Nubia was not a homogeneous group. There were sophisticated urban and agricultural Kushite people who lived in Middle Nubia, C group cattle kings to the north, and to the east, a group of rural pastoralists. The cattle herders to the north may not have seen themselves as the same people as the Kush to the south. In fact, they probably saw Kush and Egypt as two powerful warring factions, with themselves caught in the middle. At various times, they had to ally with one side or the other to protect themselves, and sometimes they didn't choose Kush.
And sometimes this was a very individual decision, not one that they made as a homogenous group, because they weren't homogenous either. We have a firsthand account from one of these guys, a Nubian bowman named, I'm just going to guess how to pronounce this, Jehemau. The events he talks about in his inscription were from around 2040 BC, so he lived about 260 years after Weni did. Jehemau was also lower ranking, a Nubian mercenary recruited by the Egyptians to fight in their wars. At some time during his life, Jehemau carved, or perhaps had carved, an account of his life in a rock cliff on the west bank of the Nile in hieratic script, which was a kind of cursive version of hieroglyphs. And he was writing in Egyptian, which is how we understand it. He tells us that he and his son were recruited to serve in the army of the pharaoh Mentuhotep II during an expedition to fight people that Jehemau calls the Amu of Jati. It's not clear who these people are exactly, but they were probably Nubians, and it does seem pretty clear that Chehamel doesn't see them as his own people.
Chehamel pretty much tells us it was necessary for Mentehotep to recruit Nubian mercenaries in the north before sailing south. Otherwise, he wouldn't have the military strength to take on his enemy. He speaks of great cities fleeing and surrendering at his approach. Finally, as his sign-off, Chehamel says, quote, a herdsman driving the cattle, I am Chehamel the Victorious, having spanned the bow. Extend the arm to me, ye who depart. The Lord Chehamel says, live, prosper, be healthy.
That's kind of nice, right?
Yeah, and we're also getting confirmation of who he was. He was a herdsman, a cattle king from the north, and a bowman seeking security by allying with one strong civilization to go to war against another. There's no doubt that there were many other men and women like him who would have made similar choices. You know, a lot of these kingdoms here were crushed between larger warring factions, so they had to make a lot of strategic decisions.
Pele, Hawaiian goddess of volcanoes, fire, and rebirth.
Maeve, Celtic warrior queen and nemesis of heroes.
Kiyohime, Japanese fire-breathing snake demon.
Pesta, Norwegian spirit of the Black Death. Our book, Women of Myth, is a fascinating look at women and femme characters in world mythology, including goddesses, heroines, and monsters. With captivating illustrations by Ringo Award-nominated artist Sarah Richard, it's the perfect gift for the mythology lover in your life, including yourself.
Find Women of Myth wherever books are sold.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the next 500 years or so, the Egyptians and the Nubians warred for supremacy. Sometimes the Egyptians controlled parts of Nubia, other times the Nubians raided downstream, sacking cities and carrying off treasure and statues. They even partnered with a people called the Hyksos to attack the Egyptians to the north and south at one point. The Nubians drove the Egyptians out of their territory as the Hyksos conquered Egypt up north near the Nile Delta, driving out the Egyptian pharaohs and installing their own pharaohs. Egyptian sources speak of this time as a time of violence and humiliation under bloodthirsty Hyksos conquerors. But by 1504 BC, the Egyptians had overthrown their Hyksos overlords, and a pharaoh named Thutmose I decided to do something about those rebellious Nubians once and for all. He mounted a campaign to the south and destroyed the city of Kerma. For hundreds of years afterward, during most of the New Kingdom and after, the Egyptians maintained control over Lower and Middle Nubia, making it a nome or province of Egypt with its own governor, the king's son of Cush, in charge.
The Nubians did not take this peacefully, I mean, understandably. The Egyptian occupation of Kush kicked off centuries of rebellion. Even as they rebelled against Egyptian control, the Nubians adopted many of the trappings of Egyptian culture. But it didn't just go one way. The Egyptians also adopted many aspects of Nubian culture and fashion. For instance, King Tutankhamun, who reigned from 1342 to 1323 BC, was buried in his tomb wearing golden earrings of a distinctly Nubian style. The ancient Nubians already shared a lot of cultural characteristics with Egypt. For instance, since their earliest times, they used the Egyptian system of hieroglyphics, but they used it to write their own language, which was different than ancient Egyptian. Scholars still debate what language it was exactly. And as we've mentioned, there's no Rosetta Stone that's been found, so it hasn't been translated. And that's why most of what we know about Nubia comes from ancient Egyptian sources. It was during this time, and perhaps at other times as well, that the Kushite ruling elite started writing in Egyptian.
Kushite gods started appearing on tombs and stelae in a distinctly Egyptian style as well. The Kushites had their own vast and complex pantheon, headed by a lion-headed god named Apetamak, who is generally believed to be a war god. You can see Apetamak appearing in inscriptions looking like any other Egyptian god, except with a lion's head instead of the head of a jackal or a hawk or whatever the Seth animal is. Toward the 1000s BC, as the Egyptian dynasty of Ramses I devolved due to infighting and conspiracy, the kingdom of Kush rose in power and prominence. By this time, the city of Kerma had become far less influential. It never quite recovered after it was destroyed by Thutmose I in the 1500s, and a city called Napata rose in prominence. Napata was further upstream, between the 4th and 5th cataracts. This was the Napatan period of Nubian history.
In 1077 BC, Ramses XI died, and the new kingdom died with him. What followed was a period of fracture and instability. The kingdom splintered, with various princes, warlords, and other factions taking control of different sections of the Nile. To all intents and purposes, for hundreds of years, there was no Egypt. Egypt was gone. The first king of Kush that we have a name for was a man named Alara, who ruled from 785 to 765 BC. Alara took control of Nubia up to the Third Cataract, including the historic, but probably a bit run down by now, city of Kerma. In 765 BC, his brother Kashta came into power, and he went further, expanding Nubian dominance beyond the First Cataract and deep into what had once been Egyptian territory. Within a generation or two, Nubians had kicked out all the disparate warlords and reunited all of Egypt, all up and down the Nile, from the Sixth Cataract all the way to the Nile Delta. This was the 25th dynasty.
The 25th dynasty ruled for over a century, from roughly 744 to 656 BC. It's approximately a century. My math is bad.
Yeah, give or take. I mean, we're not going to quibble.
Yeah. I've seen some historians say that the 25th dynasty was heavily Egyptianized by this time. Although actually calling it Egyptianization may be a bit problematic because it implies that some of these traditions didn't originate in Nubia, which may have been the case sometimes, or that the cultural exchange didn't work both ways. But by this time, the cultural exchange had intensified, and the Nubian ruling elite had adopted many aspects of Egyptian language and culture and artwork and sent their kids to be educated in Egypt, although this cultural exchange, as we've said, worked both ways. However, between the death of the new kingdom and when Kashta and Alara and their descendants unified Egypt, Egypt as a kingdom hadn't existed for centuries. The Nubian ruling elite may have seen themselves as the great keepers of a shared culture, the ones who had nurtured the flame of an ancient tradition for hundreds of years, even as it died on Egyptian soil. They were the last Egyptians now. They had been the last Egyptians for hundreds of years, and now they were bringing Egypt back.
The 25th dynasty pharaohs were still Nubian, though. They saw Napata, the more recent capital of Nubia, as their spiritual home, and basically their hometown, and they buried their royalty there. But as rulers, they did reunify Egypt, creating a powerful new kingdom that controlled the Nile from the Delta to the Last Cataract. They revived Egyptian art and religious practice, and even brought back the ancient tradition of pyramid building. The Nubians built over 255 pyramids, more than double the number built by the Egyptians. By the time the Nubians started building their pyramids, no Egyptian had built one in over 1,000 years.
The first Nubian pyramids were built in 751 BC at El Kuru, a royal necropolis between the 3rd and 4th cataracts. King Kashta had his own pyramid built there, as well as other important Nubian rulers. You can still see the Nubian pyramids today in what's now Sudan. They were similar to Egyptian pyramids, but the Nubians had their own distinct style. And first I'm going to point out the similarities between Egyptian and Nubian pyramids. Like the Egyptians, the Nubians built their pyramids alongside temples to worship the dead. Inside, they painted detailed scenes from the life of the deceased on the walls. Mummified bodies would be placed in large, heavy sarcophagi, not unlike those of Egyptian pharaohs, the greatest of which weighed 15 tons.
However, the Nubian pyramids were also quite distinct. They were made of mud brick and stone and were smaller and steeper than Egyptian pyramids. Most of the Nubian pyramids range from 20 to 98 feet in height, and the footprint is fairly small, so the angle rises at about 70 degrees. Egyptian pyramids of the same height had bases as much as 5 times larger and inclined at angles between 40 and 50 degrees, so they weren't as steep. Most of the Nubian pyramids were looted in ancient or more modern times. In the 1830s, Italian treasure hunter and tomb raider Giuseppe Ferlini destroyed over 40 of the pyramids in search of treasure. He was trash. I'm sorry, Giuseppe, not a cool thing to do. Anyway, archaeologists did discover some artifacts in these tombs. Bows and quivers of arrows, thumb rings used by archers, horse tack and harnesses, furniture, pottery, glass and metal vessels, jewelry, entire cow skeletons, eye ointment, and ringing rocks that could be tapped to create a bell-like sound.
So all that is nice and all. We've talked about the Nubian pyramids, the culture, the longbows, but there's one element of Kush we haven't mentioned yet. Perhaps the most important element of all, and something that made the Kushites, the Nubians, however you define it, unique in the ancient world. Women had a surprising amount of power and influence in this culture.
Yeah, they did.
Hell yes. Strong, powerful warrior queens. So, let's go back to the time of King Kashta, who built on his brother Alara's work by conquering land in Egypt past the First Cataract. Kashta wasn't the one to unite the entirety of Egypt. That took the work of several successors, starting with his son Piye. But one thing he did was conquer Thebes. And when he did that, he put his daughter in charge.
And of course, we mean Thebes in Egypt.
Right, not Thebes in Greece. Two different towns.
So, that daughter was Amenirdis I, and the title her dad bestowed on her was God's Wife of Amun. This had already been a title for powerful women in Egypt for more than 1,000 years by this point. In the beginning, it was the title of a pharaoh's wife or mother. By the time Kashta invaded, the God's Wife of Amun was also the highest-ranking priestess in the cult of Amun, which was at times almost as powerful as the pharaohs, if not more powerful. And Amenirdis played a key role in the Nubian conquest of Egypt. By putting Amenirdis in charge, Kashta expanded his control north of Thebes, giving him and later rulers a foothold to launch further campaigns. So the 25th dynasty began their reign with a powerful woman in charge at Thebes, playing an important role in bringing territories to the north to heal.
This isn't surprising. The ancient Nubian royal women were accustomed to a great deal of power and influence, and scholars believed that the Kushites had a matrilineal succession process. The heir to the throne was the royal woman's son, and the royal woman could be a sister or a close relative of the king, not the king's son. But this isn't 100% accepted or understood, especially in the earlier periods. Also, the king's son might at times have been the same person as the king's sister's son because the Kushites also practiced royal incest.
Because this family tree was a circle, as we've said many times.
It was, you know, one of the things that the Egyptians and the Nubians both did.
And the Julio-Claudians and, you know, let's...
And the ancient Greeks. Everyone's got an uncle dad, yeah.
And the Romans, I mean...
This is not the only culture that did this, by any means. However, it's fairly clear that Amenirdis I, the god's wife of Amun, strengthened the influence of women in the royal family. Many 25th dynasty pharaohs were depicted during their own coronation ceremonies with their female family members in prominent positions, usually mothers or wives. It's believed that these women held the title of God's Wife of Amun, which gave the royal women a crucial role in conveying authority to a new pharaoh.
Amun was an ancient god in the Egyptian pantheon. Originally a god of air, he was merged with the sun god Ra in the 1700s BC and was at one point the most important god in the pantheon. As the God's Wife of Amun and head priestess of Egypt's most important god, the royal woman was a kind of conduit to Amun himself. It was she who passed on Amun's approval to the next pharaoh. The 25th dynasty ended in 656 BC, but Kush continued to be a powerful and important kingdom. Around the 300s BC, the Kushites moved their capital to Meroe, a city deep in Upper Nubia, between the 5th and 6th cataracts. During this time, Nubian culture started to show a certain amount of Hellenistic influence, but that didn't apply to their queens, because the Meroitic period was also the time of the great Kandakas.
You can see it start to happen in the paintings and inscriptions on the walls of those steep Nubian pyramids. Many of those pyramids were for powerful ruling women. One of the largest of the pyramids, the one that was 98 feet high, was probably built for a queen from the early 1st century AD. And everywhere inside those pyramids, from the tomb inscriptions and paintings to the bows, arrows, chariots, and horse tack the women were buried with, the evidence is clear. These were warrior queens, some of them famous. By the 300s BC or so, what emerged was a tradition of powerful warrior queens with their own special title, Kandaka. These were often not women who were powerful due to their proximity to kings, but women who were kings themselves.
It's unclear what the word kandaka means. Scholars speculate it might have meant something like queen mother or royal woman. The kandaka was the official title of the sister of the king of Kush. The next heir to the kingdom would be her son, not the king's son. The kandakas were women who ruled. For many of them, their husbands were lesser consorts, and they ruled in their own right, not as regents for underage sons. Reminds me a bit of Cleopatra.
The funny thing about Cleopatra was officially she was supposed to rule as a regent for her brothers, but she killed off her brothers so that her time of reckoning wouldn't come where she'd have to share power with them. She just killed them off at the age of majority.
Yeah, and then she just made Mark Antony her consort, and so she answered to no one but herself. I mean, I'm here for that.
Well, she was creating that situation, you know, like the system didn't want to give it to her. She engineered it for herself.
Yeah, because say what you want to say about Cleopatra, she was bloody brilliant. Anyway, they led armies into battle, wore regalia and clothing traditionally reserved for male kings, were depicted wearing armor and brandishing weapons, commissioned the building of temples and pyramids, took on male ruling titles, and were shown in artwork smiting their enemies, just like the first Egyptian pharaoh, Narmer, some 2,000 years beforehand.
I saw somewhere, like I kept seeing this one thing repeated, but I couldn't actually track it down to an ancient source. I just wanted to repeat it because I love it, but I'm not sure how factual this is. That the kandakas were kingmakers so powerful that not only did they choose which of their male relatives became king, but if they didn't like how he was doing, they could order him to abdicate by taking his own life. And the king had to obey. So the kandaka could order her son or brother to take his own life if she didn't like the job he was doing as pharaoh or king.
Hot.
I can't say how true that is.
Like, I'm actually swooning at that. That's not sarcastic in any way, shape, or form. That's just incredible.
Dark times on this podcast. That's what we're swooning over. Anyway, by this point, the ancient Greeks and Romans were starting to encounter these strong ruling women, and they start showing up in those sources. They describe them as queens of Ethiopia. Ethiopia starting with an A. A-E-thiopia. Which did not mean the same place that we mean today when we say Ethiopia. The ancient Greeks and Romans used that word to refer to areas south of Egypt along the Nile, as well as areas south of the Sahara generally. The word Ethiopia comes from two Greek words meaning burnt face, which is a little racist.
Feels like that's a lot racist. This word is very ancient. It first appeared in Homer in the Iliad, which would put it around like the 700s BC. It was used as both a noun and an adjective. And it meant burnt face in its noun form and red-brown as an adjective. At different periods in history, it was used by Greeks and later Romans to refer to people more or less south of Egypt, but also to refer to people in a broad swath of territory east of the Mediterranean, from Turkey all the way to India.
I mean, to me, it kind of sounds like a racial slur, or at least othering. It's not a polite thing to call people.
And, you know, we know the ancient Greeks and Romans weren't polite. I mean, the word barbarian, anyone?
Yeah, I mean, they were very othering of a lot of people who were not them.
So during this time, the powerful kandakas started to appear in sources like Pliny, Strabo, and Cassius Dio. The kandakas are even in the Bible in Acts 8:27-39, when the Apostle Philip converts, quote, a eunuch of great authority in Cush to Christianity. The eunuch served under Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. Now, the Bible is confused here. In this passage, it seems like the queen's name is Candace, a Latinized version of Kandaka, when in fact, that was a royal title. The ancient Greeks and the Romans made the same mistake, writing about these royal women as if they were all queens that had the same first name, Candace. And that makes sense because a lot of times the ancient Greeks and Romans gave all of their women the same name.
All the Antonias, you know, like they did have like a habit of naming all their daughters Julia 1, Julia 2, Julia 3.
Yeah, and some of it was about aligning the woman's name or even the man's name to the house or family they were born to. I think they made a massive mistake here. Not everyone does that. Sometimes we get to have our own names, Jenny, but not you and I. We're just a version of Jennifer.
We're following Roman naming conventions here on this podcast.
We know of approximately 10 or 11 Kandakas between 260 BC and 320 AD. But one leaps off the pages of the ancient sources, who fought Octavian after her fellow queen to the north, Cleopatra, lost her last battle and took her own life. This Nubian queen lived, kicked Octavian out of her kingdom, and held on to her rule. Her name was Amonarenus I, and this is her story.
We're not sure exactly what the start and end dates of her reign were, but Amonarenus I ruled Kush from around the end of the 1st century BC to the beginning of the 1st century AD. While Cleopatra was ruling Egypt, she was in charge of Kush, and she wanted to keep her kingdom out of Roman hands just as badly as Cleopatra did. Let's go back to the time of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, specifically just after the Battle of Actium. Mark Antony and Cleopatra went down in defeat and wound up taking their own lives, and Octavian took over Egypt and made it a province. This is around 25 BC. But Octavian wasn't content with just Egypt. No, he also set his sights on the kingdom of Kush to the south. At the time, the realm was ruled by a powerful Kandaka, Queen Amonarenus. Stele suggests she had both a husband and a son, but she was clearly the one in charge. And she was a warrior. At one point, she lost an eye, probably in battle. Strabo calls her the One-Eyed Candace, and he spells it like Latinized, C-A-N-D-A-C-E, which is why I'm pronouncing it that way. But she was unquestionably very formidable.
Augustus, who was Octavian, annexed Kush in 30 BC, making it a province of Rome. They did this by negotiating terms that the Kushites initially agreed to. But in 22 BC, they rebelled against Rome, led by Amonarenus. And we don't know exactly what sparked the rebellion. Roman writers chalk it up to, quote, ambition, or possibly heavy taxes. Whatever the reason, a Kushite army, 30,000 strong, sacked Aswan, a city just north of the First Cataract, destroying imperial statues. The Kushites wanted to send a very clear message of exactly who they were mad at. And at the head of their army in their rebellion was Amonarenus.
The Roman governor of Nubia was named Gaius Petronius, and he was the one who met Amonarenus' army in battle. Strabo describes how it went. Quote, Petronius quickly turned them to flight, since they were badly marshaled and badly armed, for they had large oblong shields, and those too made of raw oxhide. And as weapons, some had only axes, others pikes, and others swords. Now some were driven together into the city, others fled into the desert, and others found refuge on a neighboring island, having waded into the channel. For on account of the current, the crocodiles were not numerous here.
Hot. Good to know the crocodiles don't like currents, or strong currents.
Didn't know that, but now I do. Among these fugitives were the generals of Queen Candace, he spells it the Latinized way, who was ruler of the Ethiopians in my time, a masculine sort of woman and blind in one eye. That's the description we get. These, one and all, he captured alive, having sailed after them in both rafts and ships, and he sent them forthwith down to Alexandria. And he also attacked Selchis and captured it. And of the multitude of those who fell in the battle, he added to the number of captives. Those who escaped must have been altogether few in number.
From there, he attacked Nabata, where Amonarenus lived with her sons. His army razed the city to the ground and plundered whatever they could find. The inhabitants were sold into slavery. Those who weren't were sent to Octavian as prisoners of war, where many died of disease, far from their kingdom. Amonarenus was enraged. Again, she called up an army. This time she attacked Premnus, a fortified Nubian city, where Petronius had left behind Roman troops to put down future rebellions. But Petronius arrived in the area first, strengthening the fort's defenses. Instead of attacking, Amonarenus sent ambassadors. If she was going to back down, she wanted concessions. According to Strabo, quote, Petronius bade the ambassadors go to Caesar. And when they asserted that they did not know who Caesar was or where they should have to go to find him, he gave them escorts, and they went to Samos, since Caesar was there and intended to proceed to Syria from there. After dispatching Tiberius to Armenia, and when the ambassadors had obtained everything they pled for, he even remitted the tributes which he had imposed.
Octavian gave Amonarenus' ambassadors everything they asked for, including moving Roman troops out of Kush, leaving the kingdom independent, and even canceling Kush's taxes. It's not clear how long Amonarenus lived after that, but it is clear she was a remarkable ruler. Clearly Octavian did not want to mess with her further. And in 1910, a fascinating discovery was made. A bronze head of Augustus, crystal-eyed and looking rather hapless, if you ask me, dating from Amonarenus's time. It had been buried beneath the steps of a temple in Meroe, dedicated to victory, so worshippers would step on his head as they walked into the temple. Heck yes! Amonarenus left us a message, a very clear one, about exactly what she thought of Octavian.
Step on his head.
So that's it for this week. Join us next week for whatever we are discussing next. I don't even know at this point.
And join us on social media at Ancient History Fangirl on TikTok, Thread, and Facebook, and Instagram. We're most active on Instagram at the moment. And we're at Ancient Hist Fan, still haunting the decaying, bloated corpse of Twitter, or whatever it's called today.
And join our Patreon. For just $3 a month, you can get early episodes, extra episodes, videos, and more where we cover topics we didn't get to in our longer episodes. Recently, we covered the death of Pliny, all the weird, wacky weapons Archimedes supposedly created, and Luna McNamara came on to tell us a drunk myth. And you can find the Patreon at patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl.
Our Patreon is the sole reason we're able to do this podcast. If we didn't have a patron supporting us, we would have to give up a fangirl for good. So if you're on the fence about whether or not we do need support, because it sounds like we're always shouting people out, we do. Patrons come and they go, but without a steady support of people joining, the podcast would have to shutter its doors. So let's thank these patrons, Jenny.
Apologies to anyone whose name we mispronounce.
Thank you to Jim Bisbee,
Sarah Chester,
Barry McCann,
Melinda, just Melinda,
Danny Peeves,
Ramble On with Rosie,
Ryan Aho,
Taylor, just Taylor,
and Raven Letellier.
Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.